Welcome to Pick Me Up, I'm Scared, the podcast.
I'm your host, Madeline.
And I'm your co-host, Kenna.
All right, Kenna. Today, we're going to start with a question like we always do.
Oh, golly.
This question is, what do you throw away in a day? Like what? Like a list.
Oh, I'm kind of ashamed to say. I mean, probably like 2 Diet Cokes. I recycle them. Let's see. Food trash, like leftover food. Maybe like some paper towels. If something like spill, I'm kind of messy at home. Like if something spills, paper towels. I feel like it's mainly the food trash and the Diet Coke and like beer cans.
So cans, food, like scraps, like food scraps.
Trash, like, you know, if something falls on the floor.
Got it. Okay, so I actually like made myself a list of everything I threw away yesterday.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So here was my list. I threw away 1 can of coffee Coke. 1 biodegradable straw. What is this? Oh, yeah. 2 plastic containers that food had come in them for the dinner I made last night. But I rinsed them out and I recycled them. And, well, I didn't make dinner. Chris made dinner, obviously. I didn't make the dinner. I threw away 1 biodegradable container from my lunch yesterday at work. Like when we got like work delivered.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it was the biodegradable container that the food came in. And then there was a piece of paper in. You know how sometimes they have like the food liner paper? That was in it as well. And a plastic fork. I threw away 2 Q-tips. And my moisturizer that I've had like for the past year finally ran out. So I recycled the plastic container that my moisturizer came in.
Oh.
Yeah. And also I would have used a biodegradable dog bag, except my dog pooped, and then I went to pick it up, and I realized I was out of bags, so I just picked it up with a really big leaf instead.
I love that move.
I'm like, that's the biggest leaf.
Sometimes, like, I was watching a friend's dog, and it was like, I didn't realize I had run out of bags, and I just found some other garbage on the street to pick it up with the garbage.
I used to do that in San Francisco regularly. I never carried dog bags, and I was always like, I'll just use trash on the street. And when I moved to LA, people were like, what the fuck? And
I'm like, I'm doing good.
Yeah, 2 for 1. 2 for 1. So, like, all in all, if I were to weigh my trash from yesterday with all my, like, expert weighing assessment knowledge from working shipping for so long, I would guess that it probably weighed a total of 1 to 1.5 pounds.
I was going to say, like, because I've also worked in shipping. I'm like, between 0.8 and, like, 1.1 pounds.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good. Yeah. I think the heaviest thing was probably the biodegradable lunch container.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty big. Okay, so if you now had to guess how much trash the average American makes per day in terms of weight, what would you guess?
2 to 5?
It is 4 pounds. So yeah, you did really well. Yeah, it's 4 pounds. I kind of feel like it's a lot because I don't consider myself an especially trash conscious person. Like we compost, we recycle, and this might be TMI, but I use like a reusable menstrual cup. But that's kind of the extent of my like hippie earth friendly tendencies. I don't use the refillable jars. I don't only shop bulk or anything like that. I use plastic and paper bags pretty regularly. I use straws, and I think the biggest thing that might make an impact on my personal trash use is just the fact that I don't shop a lot, maybe. Like, I'm not, like, a consumer as a hobby.
Yeah, I think I feel like sometimes, lately, I've been letting a lot of, like, things in the fridge have been going more to waste than usual, because I'm kind of figuring out, like, my food, weekly food menu.
Yes.
But, yeah, for me, it's definitely, like, I think that I'm, like, probably a little bit below that 4 pound average, only because in the past, I got everything from thrift stores and then donated it back to the thrift stores.
Yeah, exactly. Most of the money I do spend, like, I'm going to spend it on, like, food or beverage related to going out. So, like, I'll go out and get a drink with my friends, and I'll drink, like, a cocktail, and they come in reusable cups, you know? It's not, like, a bottle of alcohol. But on the whole, I think my trash usage being lower than maybe the average person is probably more because I'm budget conscious and less because I'm earth conscious.
Yeah, I do drink a lot of Diet Cokes, and lately I've been having a beer afterward.
Yeah, the canned beverages really get me too.
I think that's what like probably gets me the most, are the canned beverages.
They're so tasty, and they bubble, and they in the can, it just tastes better in a can too than a bottle.
I love a carbonated beverage, can or bottle.
Oh really? Okay.
As long as it's you know, I have not tried when they're in the pouch. That I have yet to try. Maybe that's
they come better. In a pouch.
Sometimes you can get like little pouch drinks.
I have not seen that. That's very intriguing to me. But yeah, I feel like you touched on this earlier. Like if I'm going to go buy things, chances are it's going to be secondhand.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and that just doesn't come with as much packaging or.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
It's like just less packaging. I mean, probably since the pandemic, I've bought more stuff new just because I wasn't going to thrift stores.
Right. It's more convenient to order new online or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like you're the same way in that, like, you, shop mostly for secondhand for, like, everything you can. And, like, me too, like, house stuff, like, I don't know, like, furniture, couches, whatever, even that kind of stuff.
Yeah. But I don't know. I feel like I would have to take, like, an average of, like, a week long. And maybe I'm just average.
Maybe. I just feel like buying new things, like, in this economy, like, who's buying new things, you know?
Only since the pandemic have I started really buying, like, hardly anything new. Like, people were, like, shocked, I've had people be shocked when I'm like, oh, yeah, the towels I always just get from the thrift store and then wash on hot and bleach. And they're like,
oh, I use thrift store towels.
But right. I always buy the cute 60s ones. Or, yeah. I should not give this away, but I collect old YSL towels.
Oh, I didn't know there were YSL towels.
They're amazing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so I was thinking about how I fell prey to that Instagram ad for the tabletop composting machine.
I thought it was cool.
Yeah, so if you listen to our bonus episodes on Patreon, you'll know what I'm talking about. I saw an Instagram ad for a tabletop composter. It was peak pandemic quarantine. I had not left the house in months. And I spent like 10 weeks, I think, of my allowance, my going out money on this little thing. And it's really funny. It looks like if Apple made a trash can and it sits on your countertop. So, you know, last night I was listening to this weird little compost machine, slow, gentle whir as it turned banana peels into dirt in my kitchen. And I was wondering, you know, what the hell is this thing even doing? Was it worth it? Did I get scammed? And it just obviously led me to today's episode topic, which is trash.
I love it.
Yes.
I love trash.
This is our trashy episode.
I was just thinking of Danny DeVito from It's Always Sunny.
Oh, I love
it. Like, I'm the trash man.
I love how we took the quiz at work to see which character we were in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and I got Danny DeVito. And I was like, it's because I am the trash man. I just come out and throw garbage everywhere. Like, this is correct. So here today, where we live in the United States, Americans make up around 5% of the world's population, but we generate nearly 40% of the world's total garbage.
Whoa!
Yeah.
Wow, here, we're trashy.
We're super trashy. Here in the U.S., per person, we produce 3 times the amount of waste as an average person in China does, and 7 times the amount of waste as an average person in Ethiopia. The U.S. is the only developed nation with waste generation that outstrips its ability to recycle.
Whoa.
And developed. You know, I copied that statistic from somewhere, but the word developed is weird. I would say wealthy nation, maybe.
Yeah, I'd probably say that wealthy is probably more
appropriate.
Yeah.
But today, most American communities are spending more on waste management than they are for firefighters, libraries, or parks. And trash management is important, right? We know from history that adequately dealing with waste is a major component of maintaining public health and hygiene. Improper waste control can double your chances of getting diarrhea. Burning trash can increase your chances of getting acute respiratory infection 6 times over.
Wow, and remember that libertarian town where they didn't collect the trash because they were too libertarian? And then they were overrun by bears.
By bears! You need trash or your whole town gets taken over by bears. So there's all sorts of interesting statistics you can find online about how New Yorkers fill the Empire State Building with trash every day, or Massachusetts fills Fenway Park with trash each year, or the world fills the New Orleans Superdome with trash 1,500 times a year. The equivalent, obviously, the Empire State Building is not, in fact, just one giant trash can, but you know what I mean. So people aren't making pilgrimages to New Orleans 5 times per day to put their trash inside of it. But for someone like me with poor spatial reasoning, these types of comparisons don't really help. I'm like, what? There's a lot of people on the planet. Is 1,500 New Orleans Superdomes a lot of trash? Is that very little? I don't have a reference for that.
Yeah, it's hard to know in relation to the world.
Right. I have no clue. But what this does help me, like, kind of get my brain going in the direction of is trying to imagine the trash. Like, what I think from there is, what is the trash? What's it mostly made of? So, Kenna, if you had a guess, what do you think most of our trash is on the planet?
Food?
You're right. It's food waste. I never would have thought that, though.
Oh, I would have thought that because I feel like I cleaned out my fridge the other day and I was just like, oh, damn, this is like a lot going to waste. And like, I'm okay with like it, you know, like the expiration dates, like I know aren't the real expiration date. Like, I feel like unless it smells bad, like it's bad. But everything smelled really, really, really bad.
Yeah, well, that's pretty amazing to me that you guessed that because I had no clue this would even be on the list. But food waste in the U.S. does make up 24% of what's in our landfill.
Wow.
Yeah, so nearly a quarter of our landfills is just food waste, which sounds really dystopian to me, especially because I know people go hungry in our country.
Yeah, I feel like, too, like, I know, like, I feel like maybe I used to be more like this, where, like, you see the expiration date, you're like, oh, can't, it's gonna kill me.
Yes, definitely.
Where, like, you're throwing away food that is still good, but it's, like, from my understanding, like, it's at its peak quality on that date. So after that date, it's not necessarily going to give you botulism. It is going, it's just not at its quote, I'm doing air quotes, peak freshness.
Yeah. I actually learned this when I was in college. I had a job working for a photographer and our photo studio was actually in the very first apartment she lived in when she moved to San Francisco, like in the 60s or,
whoa.
Yeah, she bought it from the person that she was renting it from, which is like one of those stories that could only happen in the 60s, like doesn't happen anymore.
Oh my God.
And she was like working like freelance as a photographer, living off $1,000 a month. And then her landlord was going to sell the flat and she was like, I'll just buy it, you know, which like doesn't happen anymore today.
Yeah.
But she was really cool. So she had this like cool old apartment that she'd had for forever. And one day I was like going through the cabinets, like in the pantry of the kitchen of the apartment where we worked. And I was like, this is so old. Like this expired in the 80s. And she's like, yeah, but it's in a can. It's still good. And I was like, are you eating expired food? And she's like, all the time. Expiration dates, big lie. They just want you to throw away good food. Like, no, I eat it. It's an act of rebellion. And like this stood out to me in my head. And I was like, oh, I think she's right. And she was actually really, really cool. So I think she was correct. But yeah, like hearing that so much of our landfills, it's just food waste, it actually did make me feel a little bit better about my tabletop food scrap composter that I bought from the Instagram ad. It made me think maybe I don't impulse buy things from Instagram ads during global pandemics just to feel alive. And like maybe I did it because I actually care about the planet. But Americans throw out, honestly, between 35 to 40% of our food.
Wow.
It's a lot. It's a lot. Or around 43,000 tons daily.
Wow.
And 1,200 pounds of that per person per year could have been composted instead of trashed. All in all, a third of the food produced in the world for human consumption every year is completely wasted. And if we were to recover or save even like a quarter of the wasted food, it would be enough to feed around 870 million people.
Whoa.
Yeah, and that number is significant because globally, 811 million people are considered food insecure.
Wow.
Yeah, so if you're wondering if you heard that right, you did. If we fixed even 25% of our food waste issue in the U.S., we could literally end world hunger.
Wow.
Yeah, very, very wild. And food waste happens at like every single stage of the food supply chain. So first off, on farms, 20 billion pounds of produce is lost each year. So to hedge against like pests and poor weather, farmers often plant more than consumers demand, meaning that market conditions alone can cause the farm to throw out edible food. Sometimes the price of produce on the market will also be too low for the cost of transportation and labor to harvest it to even be worthwhile financially. And that means that farmers will literally leave crops unharvested because it's the more cost-effective thing to do. So during COVID peak lockdowns, farmers plowed over edible crops and dumped up to 3.7 million gallons of milk per day onto their fields rather than paying to harvest or process. And the government has programs to buy excess produce, but it's not super efficiently run, and food has an expiration date, obviously. There are also, on top of that, like, cosmetic issues with food, you know, ugly produce, right?
Oh, yeah, that's why they have the imperfect produce thing.
Exactly, and that makes things less sellable, even though they are still perfectly edible. So from a fishing perspective as well, around 8% of caught fish are discarded. They're returned back to the water either dead or dying. And one European study found that up to 60% of fish caught in the North Sea were ultimately discarded. And one U.S. study found that up to 32% of bycatch is thrown away by American commercial fishing boats.
Wow.
Yeah. Then there's food waste that happens in produce packing houses, where produce is cast out, again, for not meeting cosmetic standards. Again, that imperfect foods thing or whatever. Do you know anybody who's used it?
No, I just see their ads on Pluto TV, which I'm obsessed with. You would love this because it's free. And they stream just trashy shows.
Oh, I love that.
There's like a whole channel that's just like the Jersey Shore channel. But in between, you know, like the free streaming services, or like some of them, they just play the same commercial over and over again. And that's the one I keep getting where I'm like, do I need this cucumber with the googly eyes?
Yeah, my mom used it. I think she still uses it, actually. And she really likes it. She thinks it's really good. They just give you, like, a box of random produce every, I don't know, week, 2 weeks.
Oh.
So then there's also, wait, if you work for Imperfect Foods, this is a great sponsorship opportunity for us. I had to sneak that in there. You gotta make money. Anyway, back to our regularly scheduled programming. No, there's also waste that happens in manufacturing facilities that process things like trimming and peeling some foods. In this stage alone, around 2 billion pounds of food are wasted each year.
Wow.
Which I didn't even think of that as being a stage that food goes through. But, like, yeah, you got to, like, trim off, like, I don't know, stems and leaves and things like that.
Wow. There's so much to go along, like, into agriculture. Like, actually, like, people, because I come from, like, an agricultural state, Colorado. So there's, like, lots of, like, 4-H kids, like, where I feel like people get locked into, like, ugh, like, studying agriculture is for, like, I don't know, for rural areas. But I'm just like, oh, I feel like if more people, like, it's such an important thing to do. I'm just having a side note here. I'm like, how cool that is to know about, like, growing shit.
It's cool. It's kind of punk. Growing your own food is super counterculture. Then there's also food waste that happens in the transportation and distribution networks. Just because of, like, poor planning, things will, like, perish or spoil, or they're not refrigerated long enough, which I didn't even think about that either.
Oh, yeah.
And then in the retail business alone of food, in 2010, 43 billion pounds of food was wasted. And this is mostly perishable items like baked goods, produce, meat, and prepared meals. And the USDA estimates that grocery stores waste $15 billion in unsold fruit and vegetables alone each year. I always like to go to that weird rack, like, in the corner of the produce section at the grocery store where they sell all the produce that's just about to expire for, like, super cheap, you know? I always like to do that and, like, see what I can get. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'll eat 18 cucumbers this week. Sure. Sometimes, though, the food wasted at this stage is just, like, due to improper buying or planning on the store's part, or just, again, unattractive items. So around 10% of edible food waste is recovered and donated, but 90% of this kind of still edible food waste just ends up in landfills. Then we have, like, schools, hospitals, and hotels, where up to 11 billion pounds of food is wasted each year. And in restaurants, it's even more, up to 33 billion pounds of food every year. So up to 10% of all food purchased by restaurants is wasted in total. And it's a big driving force due to oversized portions, inflexibility of chain store management, and, like, having a really, really big menu, which can lead to certain items just never being used because people don't order them because there's so much on the menu.
I never even think about that. Like, people who, like, know about, like, restaurant management, I think that's also a very cool skill to have, to being like, order, like, be like, we got to make sure we order enough tomatoes. I'm like, that to me is, like, galaxy brain, because I don't understand that stuff at all.
Yeah, it's like meal planning, but, like, on bigger scale, because you have to also, like, guess what people are going to want to eat.
Yeah, like, I can't even do that for myself.
Very hard. And also, diners leave on average 17% of their meal left over at a restaurant. So, whoa. Yeah, we're not likely to clear our plates at a restaurant because restaurants want to give you too much food to eat. So it looks like you're getting like high value, but only around half of diners take their leftovers home with them. And lots of experts think that this is because portion sizes have increased significantly over the past 30 years, like usually due to capitalism, like to try to compete with other people. And it can end up being 2 to 8 times larger than the portion sizes that people just would make for themselves at home.
Oh.
Yeah, you want to feel like if you're going out to eat, you're getting your money's worth.
Yeah, it's like kind of why people don't like, you know, like, quote, like, fancy restaurants or like French restaurants or like the, you know, like
the portions are so tiny. Like,
oh, they're so, or like gourmet food where it's like, oh, it's so small. Cause sometimes you're like, oh, I did not like eat enough. Like this is too small.
Right. But like most restaurants, they're giving you huge portions cause they want you to be like, wow, I really got my money's worth, you know, like yeah. This was so worth it.
I feel like I always take my leftovers unless it's a situation where it's like, they're going to be left in the car for 12 hours, you know?
Yeah, now I definitely always take them, but for years I never did.
Really? I always took them.
Yeah, no, I don't know. When I was younger, I never took my leftovers, and it's not like I grew up rich or, like, didn't appreciate the food or anything. Like, I grew up really broke. I just knew myself, and I, for a long time, like, never cooked at home. I wouldn't even microwave things at home because I had, like, no experience growing up learning how to prepare food for myself. So I would just eat fast food. I eat, like, Taco Bell, like, every single day. Pretty wild. So on top of that, how a restaurant kitchen operates can lead to food waste as well. Like food scraps and trimmings, sometimes they're used for things like making a broth, but sometimes they're just thrown away. Sometimes ingredients are improperly stored, so they go bad. Sometimes like food is just over prepared, like they make too much of something and it doesn't get eaten and that goes to waste. And the most common source of food waste we see in restaurants is at all you can eat buffets.
Oh.
From a sales perspective, they want them to look fully stocked all the time. So that means at the end of the night, there's always food left over.
Oh.
Very interesting.
I do sometimes love it all you can eat. Like the salad and soup place. Oof.
What salad and soup place?
There used to be one here.
Is that what it's called?
No. Oh. Forget what it's called.
There was one in my hometown. It was like a chain, but it's called like Sweet Tomatoes.
I think that's the chain.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. So last you have like at the home level, which is kind of what you were talking about, where you like clean out your fridge and you're like, oh God, where did this guy forgot about this? And I think all of us can relate to that. We've all accidentally bought groceries, totally forgot they were there or meant to get around to using them. And whatever the case, they just spoiled before we had a chance to cook them. Life is hard. And sometimes produce turns fast.
It does. Especially, you know, there are certain places where I feel like you get an apple and the next year you're like, what happened?
That is totally true.
I feel like that used to be Trader Joe's.
You know I'm anti-Trader Joe's. You know, I hate Trader Joe's.
I love the snacks.
You're so good at finding the snacks, though. I feel like I'm not qualified to shop at Trader Joe's because I don't know how it works. But I feel like whenever you go to Trader Joe's, you're like, look at this delicious snack I found. And I'm like, how? I would never be able to find this in that store. I don't know how that store works. I get lost. I get confused. And I'm like, look, I found like a giant tub of raisins. That's all I can find. I'm not a Trader Joe's person, I guess. So whatever the cause, U.S. households waste 76 billion pounds of food per year, and nearly half of all food waste happens at the consumer level. So American households waste 21% of the food that they buy, and this costs people $1,800 a year. So when I got really into meal planning when I was at my brokest, I took pride in never wasting a single food item because I recognized food was one of my biggest expenses. I bought canned vegetables whenever I could and dry grains and lentils that didn't go bad. And it was like this passion of mine, right? But it took a lot of time and planning. So like now I've switched to a meal prep service, which works a lot better with my ADHD, still limits my food waste. And my monthly budget is the same, right? I spend $150 a month on groceries. I definitely get less bang for my buck this way. Like meals are a little simpler. They have fewer ingredients. But at least I know I'm not letting food spoil. And that is like major to me psychologically for some reason. It feels like success. But about 2/3 of food waste at home is, yeah, just due to people not using food before it goes bad. And the remaining 1/3 of household food waste is over-preparing foods. Another major thing, though, is that 80% of Americans do that thing that Kenna, you were talking about earlier, where we prematurely discard food because we're confused by sell dates stamped on it.
Yeah, and I'm like, I feel like it's a conspiracy to make me buy more creamer.
Yeah, I think you might be right. These dates are not the same as a use-by date. And even a use-by date doesn't mean that the food is spoiled or bad right away. However, most Americans in particular err on the side of safety, you know, and discard things if they see a sticker that even suggests it might be old.
Yeah, I mean, because food poisoning is scary. If you've had food poisoning even once, you ever want to get it again.
Yeah, it's not worth it, for sure. I feel like I now, inspired by my old boss in the apartment with all the food left over from the 80s, I've maybe gone too far the opposite direction. Like, I'll have leftovers and my boyfriend will be like, those are from last week. And I'm like, I'm aware. And he's like, I think you should get rid of them. And I'm like, these things got another 3 or 4 days in them. What are you talking about? This is going to be fine.
I was just thinking, though, about you, like, the recent, like, Bon Appetit scandal where the guy was giving people botulism.
No, what? I don't know about this.
Because he's like, this is the recipe for this meat. And like, I think this is just, so I apologize in advance if this is not, but from my understanding, he was just like, yeah, cook the meat for this long. And people were like, no, ooh. I got botulism for this. So I feel like, to me, like, I'm more worried about how the food is prepared, especially if it's, animal products, then I am concerned about the sell-by date.
That makes sense. It also makes sense why I'm comfortable letting things go for so long, because I'm vegan. Yeah. So I don't eat the animal products.
When I was vegan, I never worried about things expiring. Except for, man, if you've had, like, I feel like there's been one thing in my life where I'm like, this will never go bad. Like, it was, like, almond creamer. And I was like, oh.
Okay, I had a similar experience with a coconut-based fake yogurt once. So I get that. Sometimes the fake dairies, they go bad like the real dairies.
They do.
So the biggest thing, though, about all of this that kind of goes along with this idea we have from childhood, like, that I think is interesting is, do you remember parents used to tell kids, like, oh, you got to eat everything on your plate because other children are starving?
My mom was never did that, because she said that her parents made her do that and she thought it was, like, torturous. So we just had to eat a bite of everything. And if we hated it, she wouldn't make us eat it.
That's really nice. My parents didn't do this either, but I do remember it was, like, a trope in childhood. Like, you see in movies and TV.
Oh, I know people who are just like, I have to clean my plate or else I feel terrible.
Yeah, like, I remember this never making sense to me, though, because I'm like, if I eat this or not, it doesn't affect whether or not someone else gets to eat. It's not, like, related.
They don't want our used food.
No. So the issue is that these things need to be addressed, obviously, at a systemic issue in the farming, packaging, and retail phases. Our obsession with the free market leads us to allowing food to go to waste, like, at all of these base levels, right? However, implementing food recovery systems for mass free food distribution at, like, the farming, packaging, and retail phases, that actually could help end hunger. So countries like France have implemented steps towards recovering lost food, and as a result, they actually waste 1/3 less per person than the U.S.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. The one thing you like about France.
You know what? my opinions about France are too politically divisive.
For this podcast.
For this podcast. They think they're so cool. So other countries have had success with food saving initiatives, including the UK, who between 2007 to 2018 reduced national food waste levels by 27% through implementing steps at the supermarket and food industry level.
Oh, that's cool.
Okay, so that's kind of the food waste thing. But up next in our landfills after food waste, can you guess what it is?
Plastic?
You're right. It's plastic.
Oh my God.
You're really good at this. Yeah. 18% of landfill trash is just random plastic. And that makes sense to me, but it's also a pretty, like, broad category, right? So I wanted to dig into this a little deeper. And what I found is that similar to my daily trash creation, most households' daily plastic waste comes from packaging.
Yeah. Like, I just think about, like when I do a spring cleaning or, like, really do, like, a deep, like, dive. I love the Marie Kondo style. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm just like, oh, there's all these bottles of product that I have, like shampoo that I didn't use. I have very sensitive skin, so a lot of times products will make me break out in hives and I just can't use it anymore. And then I feel so bad. Like I'll save it for my sister, but she also has sensitive skin. And then I'm like the bottles, and then I try to use them. So yeah, lots of plastic bottles.
Yeah. Well, you can always give me your weird products.
Now I know that. Now you know. I just assume everyone has sensitive skin like me. And I'm like, I'm going to poison them if I give them this body wash.
No, I was talking about this at work the other day. My boyfriend is very, very upset with me because when I was cleaning up, I found all these travel sized, like sampler type packets of like random skincare products and shampoos and conditioners. And I made giant Franken bottles of all of them mixed together. And he was like, this is so disgusting. This smells disgusting now. These smells aren't supposed to mix. And I'm like, I am not letting them go to waste. So I'm repulsive, apparently.
No, I respect that. I have a skin condition.
Yes. Well, give me your waste. I will use your waste. So packaging represents around 65% of household trash, which is huge.
Yeah, I believe that.
Yeah, and most packaging is plastic. Nearly one-third of the waste generated yearly in the United States is from product packaging alone. And other large categories of plastic waste include things like plastic cutlery, which I was guilty of, disposable cups, forks, spoons, and knives.
Yeah.
Yes. Pens, like writing pens.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Americans throw out 1.6 billion writing pens per year.
Okay, I propose that we all go back to the ink and feather model. I mean, and we all use quills. I think that would be sick.
I think it would be cool. I think we all can agree calligraphy is very sick.
I am a great calligraphist. Is that a word?
Calligrapher. Wait, have you done it before?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
My handwriting is pretty good. Like, not to toot my own horn.
I think you need to give classes then in calligraphy. And teach us. I'm open to it.
I would get so I'm a bad teacher.
Okay, so the other, like, really huge component of plastic waste, though, this one, like, blew my mind. Are you ready? Disposable diapers.
Oh, I bet. I lived with my roommates who had a baby, and they used the cloth diapers. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't, and every once in a while they used regular diapers because sometimes you're just like, oh, fuck, we're on a road trip, like, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes you gotta. And I was just like, if they hadn't have used those cloth diapers in our household, our trash would be next fucking level.
Yeah, it's pretty disgusting to think about. I don't know why I didn't think about this, but yeah, disposable diapers, they're just huge plastic waste. Like, it's mostly plastic.
Yeah, I understand why people use disposable diapers because sometimes there's a lot of poop.
It's a lot. And also, I don't know what it's like to be a parent, but it sounds very exhausting.
Yeah, and sometimes you're just, and you have to, like, they had a cool system, though, where they would, like, spray all the poop into the toilet, and it was, like, kind of a fun type thing. We're the type of people though who thought it was funny.
Yeah. Wow.
But like, I could imagine after like a long day of dealing with a baby and then you have to use like a poop fire hose to clean the cloth diaper.
Yeah. Well, these disposable diapers, they are made with non-recyclable polyethylene plastic, which takes 300 years to break down.
Oh, that's so bad.
Yeah, it's really bad.
And I feel like they just, I mean, this is, you know, I just think that they need to make, if there needs to be some sort of nationalized baby poop service.
I think so too. The babies, they're pooping a lot. The countries, they want people to make more people, right? Yeah. They're into that.
Like, people, babies, cute.
I mean, I am glad you think babies are cute. I think
babies are cute. Is that controversial?
No, it's not. It's not. It's not controversial. I think it is a very normal, healthy way to relate to small, innocent things that need to be cared for. I respect the babies.
They're like little potatoes.
I do not think potatoes are cute either, but I love that for you.
But I just think that, like, the system of childcare is just so fucked up and just like
so fucked up.
You would save, okay, you would just save so much money dealing with waste. Like, cities, you spend a lot of money on managing waste, dumps, you know. Like, if you just, you could, I'm sure there's like some really smart people out there who's just like, oh yeah, I have a logistical system for dealing with all the baby poop.
I think there needs to be a system. And then
everyone would be all happy. They're like, oh, there's just a truck that comes, like the milkman, but it's the baby poop man.
The baby poop man. I agree.
Person.
Or person. Damn it. The baby poop person. Well, yeah. So I think that this definitely needs to happen because these disposable diapers, on top of taking 300 years to break down, they're also full of toxic chemicals and microplastics that get released. Why are we
putting them onto babies?
I don't think the babies want them. Oh, no. And an average baby goes through 10,000 disposable diapers before it's potty trained.
Oh, no.
Yeah, which means in the U.S., we use 18 billion disposable diapers per year or 49 million per day. So our landfills are just full of baby poo wrapped in plastic, basically, sitting there for 300 years while more plastic-wrapped baby poo gets thrown on top of it each day.
Oh, okay. So now I understand. So I was listening to, like, NPR or something, and they were talking about, like, you know, natural parenting. And someone, I don't know if it was Alicia Silverstone or, like, some other baby celebrity. I mean, I don't. But anyway, they were talking about, like, you can, like, they didn't use diapers. And they're like, you can learn to pick up on your baby's signals on when they're going to pee or poop and just hold them over the toilet.
What?
I thought that was so cool if it's real and that works. But it's just like people say that you can potty train your cats and I haven't seen one yet.
Okay. I instantly thought of the cats when you said that. Yeah.
Can you? Is that, I know people say they can like on the YouTube videos, but is it realistic?
I mean, I don't know how realistic it is, but I imagine if you were rich and you were Alicia Silverstone and you have millions of dollars, you're just sitting around all day. You can definitely.
You can just like look at your baby's face all day, which would be cool.
Yeah.
If you're into that. You're... And just be like, they twitch their eyebrow. They're going to poop.
Yeah. And you're like, I got this. I feel like if that's the world you live in where you're sole focus and you have no stress about money and you're just like, I'm here for this baby. You could probably hold it over a toilet every time
you
need to
go. Make that, you know, like Bunny the dog with the little pad, like
yes,
little
the buttons,
the buttons, and you maybe you could make that for a baby.
Yeah, you probably could,
and they could be like poop now.
Yeah,
see, we're solving the baby poo problem.
There is a baby poo crisis, and Kenna has solutions. So another big component of plastic waste is also children's toys.
Really?
Yeah, the U.S. has 4% of the world's children, but we throw away 40% of the world's toys.
You know, I will say that if you go into any thrift store, that is a big part of the thrift store, is the toy section.
There's a lot.
And I could imagine, like, a lot of people being like, ugh, I don't know about, like, used toys. But I'm like, babies want to eat weird stuff off the ground. They're probably fine if you wipe it off.
I feel like I got a lot of used toys as a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was nice. I definitely liked it. So that's kind of, like, the bulk of what the plastic waste is. So the next step, this one really surprised me. Wow. I don't know if you'll be able to guess this one, so I'll just tell you. But do you want to try?
Wait, okay. So it's plastic,
baby. Food waste, food, plastic.
Baby stuff. Oh. Ooh.
It's hard.
Pool noodles.
No, it's not pool noodles. No. It's not pool noodles. Good guess, though. It is paper waste.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, this kind of made sense to me, I guess. But I think in my head, I thought, like, most paper's biodegradable or, like, most paper can be composted. But 12% of our total trash is paper. And there is a lot of paper in our lives that I didn't realize it can't be recycled or it can't be biodegradable because it's, like, glossy finished and treated with a bunch of stuff.
Oh, that makes sense. Because in my mind, too, it'd be like, it's just paper. It's tree. It turns into another tree when after a while.
Right. It goes back into the earth. It becomes dirt. But no, it's got like we treat them with like glossy finishes and sometimes they're heavier and they have inks on them and dyes and stuff. And yeah, it just sits in landfills. So then after that, we have coming in with a 9.5% occupancy rate in our landfills is metal.
Oh.
Yeah. So the U.S. discards around 2 billion razor blades per year alone.
Oh, yeah. Like the disposable ones. Although I am very scared to use the old-timey ones. You know, the straight razors.
That's very scary.
I think I saw something on like a horror movie when too young. No. So I can't do this. If I had to, but I'd just stop shaving.
No, I think I would just stop shaving too. Our beauty standards are impacting way more than just our psyches, evidently, right? They are also impacting our landfills. And Americans also dispose of enough steel each year to build every single new car that is sold in America.
Whoa, could we make razor blade cars?
We probably could make razor blade cars. I think you're full of really good, innovative. I think you've got a lot of $1 million ideas today. And someone needs to come in here and just swoop them all up.
I'm available.
You're on fire. You have R&D, I think they call that. In fact, research and development. Kenna. So another part, though, of metal waste is e-waste, like electronic waste.
Oh, yeah. Like, that's why I guess if you have like an old TV or something, you can take it to Goodwill, but I don't know any other way to dispose of it.
Yeah, and like 60% of e-waste is just metal. So every year, 50 million tons of electronic waste is created on the planet. And in the U.S. alone, more than 140 million cell phones are thrown into landfills every year.
I fucking hate that you have to get a new cell phone like every 2 years. Like, this is another conspiracy I have. How come whenever you pay off your phone, like if you do a phone plan, your phone starts to die?
Well, it's not a conspiracy. Actually, because we all actually know that Apple consciously designs the battery life of the iPhone to fail after a year or two, so people buy a newer model, and that's also how long your contract usually is before you pay it off.
I hate this so much. Like, you know, like, I hate it when people are like, you know, like old people are like, they used to make it better back in the day. I hate it, except for I was just like, I feel like, you know, when there are things like, I've heard the conspiracy that like actually when the light bulb was created, there was a light bulb that could last like 100 years, and they just haven't made it because they want people to buy more light bulbs.
I haven't heard that, but that checks out, honestly, because like there's this system I feel like we usually do. Like, I think of this as like the natural lifestyle of a cell phone. It's like your rich friend gets the new model and then they're like, hey, do you want my old cell phone? And it's nicer than yours. So you're like, oh, yeah, I'll take it. So then you have your old phone, and then your friend who's like even broker than you is like, oh, your old phone's newer than my phone. So then you just like pass down your phones like into perpetuity for forever. Like, I thought that's just what everybody did. So the idea that people are just throwing their old phones away kind of like blew my mind.
Yeah, I mean, I believe it. I think that too, like, it goes against capitalism to be like, this, I'm holding up my phone. Like, this phone will last you until the end of your life. Like everyone's mind would be like, what? You can't, like, even if you're like, obviously that would be great. You'd never waste it. The phone would last forever. People would be like, no fucking way.
Yeah, you can't do it because a major component of capitalism, obviously, is planned obsolescence to sell more things.
Yeah.
Like the light bulb story, which may or may not be true.
Yeah, I want to look this up. I will have to look it up later.
Yeah, it'll be, bonus maybe we'll do it on a bonus app, yeah. At any rate, if all U.S. cell phones were recycled in a given year, it would save enough energy to power 25,000 households for that entire year.
Wow.
Yeah. And recycling 1 million laptops saves the energy equivalent of powering 3,600 American homes.
Wow.
However, despite all of this, according to the EPA, only 12.5% of e-waste in the U.S. is recycled.
Wow.
So after metals, the next thing we have is wood.
Oh.
Yeah, wood just fills 8% of our landfills. And this would not have made sense to me until I started trying to fix things around my house. And oh my God, lumber waste is such a thing. Like, we have a shed outside that we call our trash house. And it is literally just full of random scraps of wood that we swear we'll use one day from, like, household projects.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, like, a major thing. People throw away a lot of wood. And then the next one, this is really going to speak to us. It's textile waste.
Oh, yes. Because yes. I just assume everyone just donates to the thrift store.
Yeah. Well, we both work in fashion, and we both are also old enough to have existed before fast fashion really took off in the 90s.
Yeah. I remember when Forever 21 was like, oh my God. All the cool girls worked at Forever 21.
Yeah. So, like, this is not surprising to me that now we have so much textile waste. Because you and I have seen in our lives how people relate to shopping and clothes just absolutely changed since our childhood. I feel like even rag houses alone, they're so much more full than they used to be. Have you noticed that?
Honestly, like, when I go to a thrift store now, it's like the amount of like Zara, Shein, like
Forever 21,
you know, H&M is, yeah, just like, it used to be like maybe like a little bit, and now I feel like it's like half the racks.
Yeah. So can you describe what a rag house is for people who might not know?
A rag house is like basically like if a thrift store has excess clothing or like a place has excess clothing, they take it to a rag mill and they sort out usable clothing from clothing that would be considered rags to be used in like stuffing. Some sort, like, they recycle it into just, I think mainly, like, stuffing and, like they use it, I don't know what they use, industrial stuff.
Yeah.
But, like, they call it rag mills because some of it used to be used for, like, industrial rag rags, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, I describe it as where clothes go to die, because it's the last step usually before the landfill. And it is where donated secondhand clothes, they get sorted, and we decide what can be recycled, what can be used, what can be turned into industrial rags, like kind of sad, what needs to be incinerated, what can be sold to special collectors, like in the vintage market. And these are usually clothes that thrift stores and charities have already rejected. They're like, we can't use these, so they give them to a rag house because it's one more chance at life before it just gets landfilled. Now, the thing is, in our lifetime alone, we've seen a huge spike in just the amount of clothes that people buy. And that obviously is correlated with a huge spike in garment waste, just people throwing out more clothes than they used to. So, kind of when we were kids, 1992, I was 6, you were 7, the average American bought around 40 articles of clothing per year.
Okay, sounds about right.
Yeah, it's a lot to me. I don't think your or my family's probably did that, but still, that was the average. So that means like 3 to 4 pieces per person per month. Now, by 2005, when we were in college, that number had spiked up to nearly 70 garments per person per year. Whoa. Nearly doubling.
I mean, for me, it would probably be more than that, but again, it's all secondhand buy sell trade.
Yeah.
I think basically I have a little bit of a shopping problem, so I just tried to do the best I could with it.
Yeah. I feel like most people, though, they're not shopping secondhand, so they are shopping fast fashion. And most people think that Zara invented fast fashion in the early 1990s. So the New York Times used this term to describe Zara's mission at the time, which was to get a garment from design to being literally sold in stores in 15 days.
Whoa.
That is just ridiculous if you don't know. So Kenna and I work in fashion, and I think it usually takes 6 months to get a garment from concept to sell date. A fast turnaround would be 3 months.
Yeah, I feel like the fastest I've ever seen for something very, very simple and just happened to be good timing was 3 months.
Yeah. And the thing about fast fashion is that these fast trend cycles meant new arrivals were hitting the store constantly. So people would buy something, and then 2 weeks later, there'd be something new there, and what they just bought was already out of fashion. And most, like, sociologists think that what kind of increased was our consumption on the whole because of this. We just needed to buy more and more pieces to feel current, but our incomes weren't going up, so the price of every piece had to get lower and lower and lower in order for companies to be able to sustain this kind of momentum. Mm-hmm. And that's led us to this place where 95% of global textiles could be recycled, but 73% of them still end up in a landfill or an incinerator. So we only recycle around 13% of our clothing here. And even when you donate clothes to a thrift store, they only sell between 10 to 20% of what they receive. Sometimes it's due to damages, but usually it's perfectly good product. There's just not enough of a consumer demand for it, and more keeps on getting donated every single day. So all in all, 62.5% of our clothes end up in a landfill, and that's 10 million tons in the USA each year because not enough people shop secondhand and because we are just obsessed with buying shiny new things.
Yeah.
So the next biggest occupier of landfills in the US, it's yard trimmings.
Oh, the yard.
The yard.
I hate lawn care.
So if you listen to our very first episode, it was all about how lawn care is evil and we should all just probably have like natural gardens which grow and they're happy to grow where we live because that's where they naturally occur. And then you don't have to do so much yard maintenance. But we don't have that, right? We have the United States where we like to just pump in as much unnatural stuff that doesn't want to be in our yards as possible. And it creates a lot of yard trimmings, and that comes in just under textile waste in our landfills at 7%. So when I lived in San Francisco, I lived there for 5 years, and all over the city, if you saw a trash can, you would actually see 3 trash cans, not just one. There would be a recycling, there'd be a regular trash, and there'd be a composting bin. So I got super used to seeing composting as a normal part of trash life when I lived there. And then when I moved to LA, I remember touring my new apartment building, and I asked the building manager where the composting trash was, and she just looked at me like I was out of my mind, and she was like, we don't even have recycling here. And I was like, you have 2 giant trash things though. And she was like, yeah, they're both just normal trash. It all goes the same place. And I just, my mind was blown. I was like, oh, we're not in Kansas anymore, basically, you know? Now though, years later with my own house, I realized that we do actually have curbside composting initiatives for yard trimmings here in LA. Like we have 3 bins for your house. There's a blue for recycling, a black for trash, and a green for yard waste. The composting, though, it isn't nearly as intense as San Francisco's system. but it is still something. And what I've come to learn is that even having something, you're only like half likely to get that in the United States, because half of the states in the U.S. Have laws banning yard waste from entering landfills, but half don't.
Interesting.
Yeah, so if you live somewhere where you don't have those green composting bins with your city, you're literally just throwing your yard trimmings and your compostables into normal trash.
Huh. Yeah, when I lived in Portland for many years and there was the compost, and then they, at one point they started collecting trash only every other week. So damn, if you missed a week putting it out, your trash got... Like, I feel like for a while, people were, like, trying to find places to, like, put their trash because it was so new, where people were just like, fuck, because they were trying to get people to, like, compost, but, like, not everything is compostable.
Yes.
And, like, there were, like, articles being like, new parents don't know what to do with their diapers.
Oh, it all comes back to the diapers. Mm-hmm. Well, also, your home state of Colorado has some of the best composting initiatives.
Oh.
Yeah.
Not in the town where I'm from.
So beyond all of this, in our landfills, we also see like smaller categories of trash being produced, things like glass and rubber, which is mostly tires, and leather, random things like that. And that all kind of composes the makeup of what we mean when we talk about trash. So to me, the thing that stands out is how some of this is just tied to our daily living, right? Like food scraps and wood and yard waste and diapers. But a lot of it is tied just to capitalism and consumption, like plastic packaging and clothing. And all of this leads us to this place where we seem to be having a bit of a garbage crisis.
Ooh.
Yeah, so from 2015 to 2018, the U.S.'s waste generation rose nearly 12%. The World Bank thinks that human garbage consumption globally will rise 70% by the year 2050, and our cities are already running out of places to put our trash. So for a number of cities in the U.S., landfills reached capacity in the mid-1970s, and we've been struggling to acquire more landfill space since then. Landfilling garbage creates problems of its own, too, like it can contaminate drinking water and lead to more pollution in an area. And the crisis has been mounting for decades with seemingly, like, no alarm. I even found an article from 1981 that was worried about this, where they said, "It is an urban crisis that lacks drama, but the garbage crisis is very real, and most of our major metropolitan areas are experiencing it. It is likely to grow worse in the coming decade." And they were right. It did grow worse, and it continues to grow worse today. And it's pretty shocking when you consider the fact that landfills, as we think of them, weren't even used regularly until the 1960s. So by the mid-1970s, they were already full. But they were only, you know, 15 years or so old. Before that, people would just bury or burn trash. New York City used to dump all of its trash into the ocean until like the 1950s.
Whoa.
And once the landfills hit capacity in the mid-1970s, the U.S. was like, well, so much for that, and started to look for other places to send its trash. So for a long time, the solution that the United States found, do you know what it was?
To ship trash overseas.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I was right.
You were right. We outsourced our trash to other countries.
Oh my God.
Yeah. In 2018, though, China was like, this is too much. We're not taking your American garbage anymore. And a bunch of other countries in, like, Asia in particular followed suit. So Thailand, Vietnam, and Malaysia all previously also received our American trash and then processed it there for recycling, reuse, or landfilling. But now they've put their foot down as well. The Western trash crisis is mounting. In 2018, 5.8 million tons of trash was exported globally, and most of it came from the U.S. It's not just the U.S., though. The government in the Philippines also recently sent 69 shipping containers full of trash back to Canada.
Oh.
They were like, we're not doing it. You take it. So it's an interesting real-time display, I think, of the effects of colonization and imperialism. The West has been using Asian countries like our literal trash can for decades, and Asian countries are standing their ground, and they're like, uh-uh, fuck this. So Thomas Wong, the manager of Impetus Conceptus, which is a company in Singapore that shreds locally produced plastic waste before sending it to recycling mills in Malaysia and Vietnam, says that a major issue with imported trash is that it's contaminated too far for easy disposal. He says that they often receive curdled milk with maggots in it next to like recyclable plastic containers. Typically 70% of a shipment can be processed, he says. The other 30% is contaminated with food. The contaminated trash has to be sent to incinerators and landfills because people don't really know what to do with it. One key reason that other countries refuse to take on the U.S.'s trash situation anymore is also that they're taking climate change and global warming a lot more seriously than we are here in the United States. And our trash creates a major climate issue for the rest of the world when they're trying to meet their own goals for progressing to, like, stop emissions and things like that. And that's because our trash situation has huge environmental impact. So we all remember, like, the Save the Turtles anti-straw trend of 2019, right?
Yes.
Yeah, while straws might not actually be the enemy, it's hard to deny the fact that globally our oceans are suffering under the weight of our waste. So annually, more than 14 billion pounds of garbage is dumped in the world's oceans. The Great Pacific Garbage Patch, or the Pacific Trash Vortex, as it's also called, is a collection of marine debris in the North Pacific Ocean that some people speculate is twice the size of the U.S., although some experts suggest that it's more like twice the size of Texas. So somewhere in that range.
Oh my God.
Basically, the series of ocean currents called the Pacific Gyre, it creates a vortex that kind of drags a bunch of trash to two different places in the ocean. So one is in the Western Pacific near Japan, and the other is in the Eastern Pacific in between Hawaii and California. So this giant trash vortex, they sometimes call it the GPGP, and it was discovered in 1997. People have called it like an island. Someone even petitioned for it to become its own country. But all of this is a little misleading because it communicates this idea that the trash patch or whatever is just like a solid mass. But even more disgustingly, I think, it's more like a trash slurry. It's water thick with garbage, and it makes it like a garbage gravy.
Lately, I have been so like, like, I saw the new Jackass, and I almost barfed, like, 8 times.
Well, not to gross you out too much, but one journalist who visited the garbage gravy... I'm sorry. I chose a good word. I'm a writer.
Oh, God. I felt that one.
So this journalist said, I found myself with my hands in the sea, pulling out toilet brush handles, bleach bottles, laundry baskets, a suspension band usually found in hard hats. There was a disposable razor handle, hydrogen peroxide container, toolbox top, flower pot, water cooler lid, luggage wheel, buckets, a VHS cassette box with a fish inside of it, an unopened bottle of carbonated water, and a piece of AstroTurf.
Oh, wow. It sounds like an art installation.
Kind of is, but like a sad, depressing one that's killing the planet. So the majority of the trash vortex is plastic, obviously, based on that description. And of plastic, 94% is microplastic, which is pieces smaller than 5 millimeters in size, which is a little under like a quarter of an inch. So while the trash slurry sludges around, some of it gets broken down into smaller and smaller pieces, where it sinks below the surface and is ingested by ocean wildlife, and then sometimes eventually by us if we eat that wildlife. Experts think it would take 67 ships 1 year to clean up less than 1% of the garbage there.
Whoa.
And almost half of all seabird species, 22% of cetaceans, and all sea turtle species, and a growing list of fish species have been documented with plastic found in or around their bodies. Mm. So while most people think that the trash in the oceans is things like plastic drinking straws and those little plastic ring things that go around 6 packs of soda or beer, it's actually mostly just waste from the fishing industry.
Really?
Yeah, around 50% is plastic fishing nets, buoys, ropes, and other general byproducts of the commercial fishing industry. And on top of the ocean trash vortex, we also have, obviously, the issue of climate change, which is affected by our waste as well. Because landfills are so densely packed, much of the degradation that occurs is anaerobically, or without air. And anaerobic processes create a huge amount of methane gas, which is a major contributor to global warming. Solid waste landfills are the third largest source of methane emissions in the U.S. as of 2021, and methane is a greenhouse gas that's 28 times more potent than carbon dioxide. The U.S. has the highest total quantity of methane emissions from landfills worldwide. And in 2019, the methane emissions from landfills in the U.S., they were equal to more than 21 million cars being on the road.
Whoa.
Experts agree that reducing methane release from landfills actually could help rapidly reduce climate change risk because it, like, doesn't last as long in the atmosphere or something. So landfills also do create, though, carbon dioxide as well. One 2010 UN report showed that if you recycle 1 ton of paper in Northern Europe, it would save 600 kilograms of carbon dioxide. And another found that it takes 70% less energy to recycle paper than it would be to make it again from raw material. So with all this information, it would sound like recycling could be a good step towards fixing this, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, you would be wrong. Yeah, no. So we're always like, everybody needs to recycle. Why isn't everybody recycling? And it turns out that actually a lot of Americans do recycle. In fact, in the United States, it's more likely that a random person you walk by on the street recycles than it is that they vote.
Whoa.
However, recycling is complicated and doesn't work the way the average person thinks it does. And in order for it to be effective, it needs to happen, like, more in a planned way at a systemic state level, not just like an individual level or a private company level, which is kind of how it happens here now. So in places like Denmark, 67% of their trash is recycled, which is nearly double what we see in the US. Here we recycle just around 34% of our trash. However, even in Denmark, recycling certain things like plastic presents a problem. And we all know that 18% of total trash in the US alone is plastic. So the reality is that recycling plastic just isn't that effective, like, anywhere. In Denmark, most of their plastic waste is actually burned, and then it's created, like, energy and heating. And only 13% of all plastic waste is able to be recycled using traditional recycling methods. And there are a few reasons that recycling plastics is such, like, a clumsy and ineffective process. So first up, in order to adequately, like, deal with our recycling, we need dedicated workers for the job just to sort through it. There's some automation in recycling for sure. Like, there's magnets and flotation and wind sifters and cameras. According to experts, though, these things don't catch everything, and manual sorting is still going to be necessary. And not a lot of companies find it profitable to hire workers to do that job. So the single best thing, like, consumers can do to ensure their garbage is recyclable is to wash it thoroughly to remove any food or shampoo or coffee or other debris that would make it hard for it to be effectively and easily recycled when it hits, like, a recycling plant. Because these are things that a worker in a recycling plant would usually have to tackle, but none of these plants want to hire workers to do it. So in places like Japan and Europe, it's pretty commonplace to pre-wash your plastics before recycling, and they do actually have higher overall rates of recycling happening there than, like, here in the US. However, even with cleaned, rinsed plastic goods without labels, the reality is that recycling plants in the US struggle to find places to actually send the recycled goods. So I feel like most people think that the way recycling works is, like, you put it out, like, in your bin, and then, like, the city comes, and they take it, and then they just, like, sort through it, and then what? I don't know. They melt it down and reuse it, and then, I guess, would sell the raw goods back to companies?
Yeah, I never thought about it that much.
I didn't either. I just thought about it to the point where they pick it up and take it away, and they sort it. And that's not really how it even really works. See, when we recycle goods here as consumers, they are not even sent straight to recycling facilities to be processed. Instead, they're then bought and sold on markets, like commodities.
Oh.
So this means that there has to be a demand for recycled plastic at the consumer level in order for recycling factories to buy more materials to process, aka our dirty recyclable goods. That whole free market thing, right? And unfortunately, there is not a lot of demand for recycled plastic, which is why we ended up with a giant trash vortex of plastic out in the ocean. The free market has fucked us again.
Mm-hmm.
So Laura Liebrich, who's a manager at Rogue Disposal and Recycling in Southern Oregon, talked about how after China in particular put a ban on importing American trash, her facility, which just sorted and cleaned recyclable goods, struggled to find places to send these goods, like, on the next step in their journey. Their little trash lives or whatever. And she talks about being able to find places to send, like, white milk jugs and soda bottles, but not being able to figure out what to do with the rest. Eventually, she just had to landfill it, and her experience is pretty common. When describing the scenario, she says, I remember the first meeting where I actually told the city council that it was costing more to recycle than it was to dispose of the same material, like just the garbage, and it was heresy, basically. And everybody in the room was like, you're lying. This is gold. We take the time to clean it. We take the labels off. We separate it. We put it here. It's gold. This is valuable. And she kind of describes this experience she had, like, watching her first load of recyclables just go into the dump. And she was talking about this and she's like, oh, it's, like, heartbreaking. Like, I feel like I lied to people. Like, I told people we were going to recycle these goods and it's just, like, not feasible. Like, I can't recycle your yogurt containers. I can't find a place for them.
Mm-hmm.
According to NPR, though, like, that's because these goods, these recyclable goods, they're not valuable. It never has been valuable. And the makers of plastic, the nation's largest oil and gas companies, They've known this all along, even as they spent millions of dollars telling the American public the opposite. So as early as 1974, one plastic industry insider wrote, "There is serious doubt that recycling plastic can ever be made viable on an economic basis. However, the oil industry makes more than $400 billion a year making plastic, and they don't want it to stop." So Larry Thomas, former president of the Society of the Plastics Industry, explained why the plastic industry continued to proliferate lies about the value of recycled goods at the consumer level by saying, "If the public thinks that recycling is working, they are not going to be as concerned about the environment." In 1990, Chevron, Exxon, and DuPont funded an ad in favor of recycling that said, "The bottle may look empty, yet it's anything but trash. It's full of potential. We've pioneered the country's largest, most comprehensive plastic recycling program to help plastic fill valuable uses and roles." Ads like this one cost tens of millions of dollars, but they existed literally just to reassure the public that them using plastic was totally fine. In reality, nobody wanted anyone's dirty plastic. The fundamental issue wasn't whether or not recycling it was possible. We know it's possible, but the truth is that picking it up, sorting it, and melting it down is really expensive, and plastic degrades each time this process happens, meaning at most it has like 2 or 3 lives total. By comparison, new plastic is cheaper and better quality. In the decades since we've been using plastic regularly, less than 10% of plastic has ever actually been recycled.
Whoa.
Yeah. So in April of 1973, one scientist told plastic executives that recycling plastic on a broad scale was completely unrealistic, saying there's no recovery from obsolete products, plastic degrades with each turnover. The scientist's report said that recycling plastic is costly and sorting it is infeasible. Another analysis from a plastic industry leading official read, "The costs of separating plastics are high, and the cost of using oil to make plastic is so low that recycling plastic waste can't be justified economically." So another thing happened with plastic in the 1990s, and you might remember this. It's when that little triangular symbol with 3 arrows on it started to become popular.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like these 3 arrows in a triangle, and there's like a number in the middle. And it was supposed to be like a code, and it was supposed to mean something.
Yeah.
Did you ever learn what the numbers meant?
No.
No, me neither. And that little stamp with the triangle and the arrows, it had this huge greenwashing effect on plastic. One small-scale recycling plant out of San Diego at the time focused on aluminum, paper, and steel, which kind of made me feel good because that means all of our Coffee Coke and Diet Coke cans, they're not so bad because they're aluminum, and aluminum can actually be recycled. So the plastic bottles, though, So the owner of this recycling plant, Coy Smith, saw the ads about recycling plastic, and he knew that it was not profitable, but he put out 2 bins for regular customers to put their soda bottles and milk jugs in. He knew he was losing money recycling them, but so few people used them. He didn't really have a problem with it because he was like, whatever, it's good for the planet, and I make up for it with all of my aluminum recycling or paper and steel. However, once the little triangle symbol started appearing on plastic, Smith reports that his little plastic recycling bins became overrun with new plastic containers. He explained, "All of a sudden, the consumer is looking at what's on their soda bottle, and they're looking at what's on their yogurt tub, and they say, oh, they have the same symbol. Well, I guess they both go in." And the result was that bins full of trash that he could not sell, and all of his colleagues also running other recycling plants had the same situation, also bins of trash they could not sell, were just sitting there stuck, and they didn't know what to do with all the stuff. So the symbol was intentionally developed to make all plastic look recyclable to consumers. And a report given to top officials at the Society of the Plastics Industry in 1993 read, "The code is being misused. Companies are using it as a green marketing tool." And the report went on to explain that this little code created unrealistic expectations for consumers about how much plastic could actually be recycled. And this is really interesting to me because I realized reading this guy's account, like, I would have been one of those consumers. I would have looked at it and been like, it's got the 3 triangles. It goes in the recycling.
Yeah, it's fine.
It's fine. But it was not, and I have no clue what those numbers mean. So in the U.S., where capitalism is king, right, the main driving decision to take on any of these tasks, including recycling, is still profit. And recycling plastic just isn't profitable enough to be implemented in the U.S. And there's a reason that we can't get past the profitability issue when it comes to dealing with our trash. And that reason is big trash. It is. It's an industry. Today, just 4 private waste management companies own over 50% of the waste hauling market, while owning 75% of permissible landfill capacity in major metropolitan areas. It really is big trash.
Oh my God.
And the top 2 garbage companies, Republic Services and Waste Management, own and operate nearly 20% of America's 2,627 landfills, and their stock prices have doubled over the past 5 years.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's a profitable industry, says Deborah Reinhardt, a member of the Board of Scientific Counselors for the EPA. It's a difficult industry, but it's profitable if it's done right. So, landfills make money from these things called tipping fees, which are fees charged to garbage trucks when they come to drop off trash. In 2020, municipal solid waste landfills had an average tipping fee of $53 and a little bit more per ton of trash deposited, which translates into roughly $1.4 million a year in average gross revenue for a small landfill and $43.5 million a year in average gross revenue for a big landfill. And like most things in the U.S., these tipping fees have risen exorbitantly in recent years. In 1982, the national average tipping fee was around $8 per ton, or about $23 in today's money when adjusted for inflation. And we know now, obviously, at $53, it's way more than double. It's a nearly 133% increase in 35 years.
Wow.
Landfill companies also make money off of our trash in other fun, creative ways. In 2011, a private scrap metal company contracted with a nonprofit landfill in southern Maine to mine precious metals from the trash.
Whoa.
Yeah, and in 4 years, they recovered more than 37,000 tons of metal worth over $7 million.
Whoa.
Landfill methane gas also can be mined in its own weird way. They harvest it, convert it to electricity, and then they sell it for high rates of return. And these are like additional money-making opportunities. And when you mix them in with the large tipping fees and government subsidies, it makes it like a really big business.
Wow, that's why Tony Soprano did it.
Oh my God, did he?
No idea. Wait, isn't that right?
I don't know. Taking out the trash, it would make sense. So since our trash is big business, it's no surprise that waste management companies have their own lobbyists too. It's like an American tale as old as time. And in a lot of places, one of the main lobbying goals is to keep states from enacting laws that would encourage people to compost their yard waste.
Oh my God.
Yeah, what they want is they want there to be a stop to these laws that kind of picked up steam where it became illegal to put your yard waste in landfills. So they're currently fighting a war on composting. And this is major because a May 2011 report from the EPA found that composting all of the food scraps in California alone would cut emissions by 5.8 million metric tons each year. Big trash wants all of our garbage. And they don't want us composting any of it because that would be bad for business. So Peter Anderson, the executive director of the Center for a Competitive Waste Industry, says their business model is based on controlling the landfills and ensuring that a lot of materials go there. So that company called Waste Management, very generic name, they spent $730,000 on federal lobbying in 2012. And they have a PAC, or Political Action Committee, that spends hundreds of thousands of dollars on federal candidates. In Georgia, the company gave $105,000 to candidates in 2010, the year before that state changed its rules about where yard waste could go. The new rule after this donation, instead of composting yard waste would now have to be sent to a landfill using a methanol capture system. One political activist called the new law the greatest setback to recycling and waste reduction we've ever had.
Wow.
And in 2010 in Florida, that same company, Waste Management, gave $235,000 to state politicians and had 13 lobbyists there working. That same year, Florida also repealed their ban on yard waste in landfills.
Wow.
So what does this mean for the future? Right? Like, Germany is the most efficient country in terms of this, I think. They recycle 68% of materials, and many Americans might look to them and be like, well, how can we be more like that? The issue is that many experts think with recycling being as complicated as it is, the future is not in recycling at all, but instead in creating single-use packaging that easily biodegrades. So this guy, Troy Swope, who's the CEO of Footprint, which is a technology company focused on eliminating single-use plastics through development and manufacturing of compostable containers. And he says, just to be real clear, recycling is a joke when it comes to plastic. It's one of the biggest lies we've ever been told. And Swope's goal is to create packaging that composts in 90 days or less and deliver it at a massive scale. His company, Footprint, is shipping billions of units per year to companies like McDonald's and Sweetgreen. Even the CEO of a recycling company called TerraCycle has said, I think recycling, and I say this as a recycling company, is not the answer to garbage. It's an answer to the symptom of garbage, maybe the best way to manage waste, but I think we have to go much deeper and enable an economy where garbage doesn't exist. But an economy where garbage doesn't exist, to me, seems pretty synonymous with an economy where capitalism doesn't exist. Reports about garbage crisis often link upticks in middle-class affluence with upticks in garbage. According to a 2012 press release from the UN's Environmental Program, by 2030, the global middle class will have grown from 2 billion to 4.9 billion. Each of these new affluent customers longing for greater quantities of more sophisticated and resource-intensive goods. Public waste systems in cities cannot keep pace. Basic human needs such as clean water, clean air, and safe food are jeopardized by improper waste management practices, with severe consequences for public health. Poor waste collection can lead to the spread of disease and improper waste disposal. For example, hazardous waste mixed with household waste can be extremely harmful for workers in the waste sector, adjacent communities, and the environment. So what we really see is that as some people get more money, their need to consume creates such a trash crisis that it adversely affects working class people both in those industries and in areas of town close by landfills. Capitalism has created an unstable system with no end in sight. David Alloway, a senior policy analyst at the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality Materials Management Program, says, in this country, most of the impacts of consumer goods and single-use items and packaging, whether it be toxins, climate change, water depletion, habitat disruption, or other impacts, is not the result of disposal. Rather, it is a consequence of supply chains, manufacturing, and production. And as our research showed, items that are recyclable and compostable are not necessarily better for the environment or result in lower human health impacts than functionally equivalent items that are not recyclable or compostable. So in short, as long as we exist in a system that prioritizes buying new shit as often as possible, we're going to exist in a nightmarish hellscape of trash. Like, for years we've known capitalism was a trash can on fire, but we maybe just didn't realize it was that literal. Short of putting a halt to capitalism, what are the potential solutions to deal with the ever-growing issue of trash? There are things we can do personally, I guess. Like, we can use less single-use plastic. We can buy more things secondhand. We can, I don't know, let less food go to waste in our homes and wash our recyclable items before putting them in the recycling container to give them a better chance of actually being reused. We can sew and repair our clothes rather than tossing them out. We can carry our reusable water bottles and reusable straws. We can fall prey to Instagram ads and buy tabletop food composters that cost us 10 weeks worth of spending money. However, the things that would actually make the biggest difference need to happen at a government or, since we live in an effective oligarchy where our government is indistinguishable from the influence of the super rich, at a corporate level. So the single most effective way to deal with our trash is just to make less of it. At a government level, a major way to address this is to stop food waste alone. EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy has said, let's feed people, not landfills. However, little progress has been made in this effort. Too much emphasis remains on the free market, which is clunky and inefficient. While food banks exist, they don't receive as much patrons or as much government assistance as something like SNAP or EBT, which rely on customers going into stores to shop for food directly. At which point we know food waste at the farming and packaging and transportation level has already occurred. For every meal a food bank provides, SNAP is estimated to provide 9. And at the food bank level, one survey found that 22% of board members worked for a Fortune 1000 company, and the greatest concentration of these were food-related businesses like major chain grocery stores. The alliance between corporate food interests and food banks is difficult to dispel and presents a conflict, which further ties access of food to major chain grocery stores. Food banks receive their food from community food drives, which provide shelf-stable items, and also directly from farmers who sometimes donate portions of their crops to food banks, as well as from companies and local businesses like grocery stores. However, this doesn't address the issue of market prices being too low to make it worthwhile to harvest crops in the first place. What if there was, for example, a government supply chain instead that paid farm workers to harvest unprofitable crops and then facilitated distribution directly to families in need through free community grocery stores? 20 billion pounds of produce could be recovered from this step alone. So we need better distribution channels to connect people with food in a way that minimizes bureaucracy. Next, we need to address corporate waste. 20 companies are responsible for over half of all throwaway plastic waste, and that's things like single-use plastics, bottles, bags, and like packaging. And the companies aren't who you might expect it. It's companies like ExxonMobil, who alone contribute nearly 6 million metric tons to global plastic waste. ExxonMobil says they're working to improve plastics recyclability, but as we all know from oil industry documents from the 70s, this has never actually been a truly viable solution. Other corporations lead the charge for creating plastic waste, like Coca-Cola, whose plastic footprint is 3 million tons of plastic packaging produced each year, or PepsiCo with 2 million tons, or Nestle with 1.7 million tons. Out of the top 8 plastic polluting corporations, 5 are American companies. So watchdog groups have found that a key element of these corporations' tactics is to shift the blame for plastic use onto consumers, and it's working. One key report says, in the United States, we revealed how the industry has successfully shifted the blame and responsibility for plastic pollution from the corporations to consumers and public authorities, all while promoting recycling as a convenient excuse to produce even more plastic. We see how fake environmental groups and increasing numbers of new voluntary initiatives are used to distract from accountability, while legislation such as plastic bag bans and bottle bills has been furiously fought against for years. So basically, we need to shift the blame back onto these corporations. In the 1990s, Swedish academic Thomas Lindqvist came with a concept called extended producer responsibility, or EPR. And the idea was that this would decrease products' environmental impacts by making manufacturers responsible for the goods' entire life cycles, especially for take-back, recycling, and final disposal. This idea has picked up traction, but we need increased regulations in this arena, which can't happen as long as our politicians take campaign donations from lobbyists within these same industries. And last, for the things that do end up in our trash cans, we need to prioritize composting at a city level. Organic waste on the whole make up nearly 50% of all household waste, and composting can handle a lot of that. While many people attempt to make composting an issue of personal accountability, the reality is that composting is kind of a big thing to take on, and it's not like you can easily compost from a studio apartment in a city. We need community-scale composting initiatives everywhere, similar to San Francisco, that don't rely on the for-profit landfill-based solid waste infrastructure we currently have in the U.S. There are currently only 500 approved compost facilities nationally that are permitted to compost food scraps. By implementing more, we can nationally mimic the success of San Francisco, who in 1996 became the first city in the nation to establish a large-scale food composting program. The city achieved the California statewide goal of 50% landfill diversion in the year 2000. And since 2012, San Francisco has diverted more than 80% of all discarded waste away from landfills. The city has advanced waste legislation, financial incentives, and the widespread three-bin system to help with all of this. Those three trash bins you see wherever you would usually find one, clearly labeled with what's recyclable, compostable, and just trash. At the end of the day, we can only do so much to change our personal relationship with creating garbage. We can shop less often, we can buy secondhand whenever possible, and we can try to work using reusable containers into our lives in realistic ways. But until we tackle corporate reliance on single-use plastic and government reliance on lobbying money from big trash, we won't be able to solve the problems of the great garbage vortex at sea. So, Kenna, what do you think?
It's funny because, like, I definitely used to think that, like, oh, people just aren't recycling and doing their part because they're selfish and they're jerks and they don't think about it. Where it's like, it's actually just this huge systemic problem caused by a few people, not just from people using straws.
Yeah, and like, actually most people do recycle.
Okay, I think the thing too is also there's this idea of like people will riot in the streets if they do not have a plastic Coke bottle. And it's like, I think sometimes though, like, yeah, some people would, but if like, I don't know, you had a biodegradable Coke can or like aluminum or something that was easily recyclable, most people when you talk about it, they're like, yeah, I'm doing something good. Like, I think that it makes people feel good to do good stuff. Like, I even think about people who are like pretty conservative who are just like, I bring my own bag to the store. Like, that became a big thing with, like, you think that would be, like, a controversial thing with people being like, I don't believe, they can't make me take away my plastic bag. And, yeah, sometimes it's nice to have a plastic bag if you have something that's leaking. Understand. But, like, people like to have their reusable, I think that people like to do the right thing, but there's a lot of misinformation out there. And I think people think that doing these sorts of little things will be such a huge inconvenience when actually the huger inconvenience is piles of trash everywhere.
Yeah, I think, like, it's really interesting. First of all, we know that per capita, per person, like, the U.S. makes more trash than other people. So we know it's a thing that doesn't have to be this way. Other people are living great, fine lives and making a lot less trash than us, right?
Yeah, especially in countries that I feel like are somewhat similar, like wealthy countries like Germany.
Right. Germany or China, very wealthy country. Yeah. They make less trash than us. They take trying to meet these climate initiatives more seriously than us.
Yeah.
And that's why they rejected our garbage.
Yeah. It's like countries that are just as wealthy, like, who have just as much prosperity.
Yeah.
Making less trash.
They're making less trash. So, like, it doesn't have to be this way. And I do think it's interesting, too, that just by, like, it wouldn't even be that big of a lifestyle change, like you said, like, to get a can of Coke instead of a bottle.
Yeah.
It's not that big of a difference. Or, like, even a glass bottle. Like, glass bottles take a million years to completely biodegrade in a landfill, but they're also easier to recycle and melt down and reuse.
Yeah. And I, like, my grandma talks about, like, getting milk bottles delivered and you just swap them out every week. Like,
right.
Or, like, when you go to the co-op, like, when I lived in Portland, so there were co-ops there. Yeah. But it's like you'd see people just, like, swap out, like, jugs and can, or, you know, glass jars of, like, lentils and stuff. It's not that big of a deal.
It's, like, really not.
Sometimes, yeah, you end up with a bunch of jars, but I'm sure you could create a, like, a logistical system for dealing with that that's actually probably easier than dealing with your trash. I think that, like, sometimes, like, it's like something new seems like impossible. And I think a lot of, like, conservative thought is that change is futile.
Yeah.
That progress is futile. So you just got to stick with what you have because it's going to be too difficult. I actually don't think it would be that difficult. I think that it's a lot of terms of, like, messaging and culture and identity. Like, you know, if you care about the earth, you're a sissy, you know, or it's like, I think that it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, it's like the unfortunate messaging with, like, COVID and stuff where it's like all about, like, I just think that there's so much weird misinformation out there that doesn't need to be, like, political. I mean, everything is political, but, like, not in the sense of, like, yeah, like, if you recycle, you're, like, a weak snowflake. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think it has to be that way. And maybe, but, I mean, again, I'm making it more about personal responsibility when I think it's more of a systemic thing.
Yeah. An interesting thing, though, what you were saying about, like changing, like, how the culture relates to recycling. In Japan, I read that it's illegal to put your trash in anything but clear trash bags. And part of the reason is that they were employing social shame. Your neighbors will know you're throwing away things that could have been composted or recycled more efficiently. And I thought that was funny. But I think the thing that was most interesting to me is, oh, there's this, like, undercurrent of how our political system works in the United States. And I'm like, well, this is responsible for a lot of the problems. Like, if we live in a country and everyone doesn't want to get rid of capitalism, like, I want to get rid of capitalism. If everyone's like, no, we like the capitalism, you're like, okay, well, there's this one key thing you could do to change our political system that would make it so that people are able to access, like, better lives within it, which is to undo lobbying, which doesn't happen in other countries. We did our episode about lobbying. And really, you see that the reason why we're not able to get laws passed and new systems implemented that are better to deal with our trash and garbage is because our politicians are being lobbied by the people who make plastic.
And what a great return on investment.
Like, yeah.
They spent $235,000 and, like, a couple lobbyists and probably made millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Oh, yeah. That's are the landfill lobbyists. There's two different ones.
That is a great return on investment.
Like, it's amazing.
I think in our lobbying episode, like, one time someone donated, like, I want to say, like, less than $20,000 and got, like, $100 million break.
Yeah.
Like, to me, I'm just like, if I were a huge corporation and did not think about, like, morals and scruples and that kind yeah. of thing, I'd be like, dude, this is my whole thing. I'm just gonna lobby now.
Like, yeah, I'm just gonna pay politicians.
I can do whatever I think I could literally do whatever I want.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting though, because yeah, now in this episode we saw two elements of that, because we saw obviously huge gas companies, right, who also make plastics, ExxonMobil, and then we also saw big trash, the landfill companies. They're getting lobbied on both ends, and it is just wild how you're like, well, this one thing, changing this one thing could like improve like the material conditions of many people's lives.
Yeah. I mean, I could like go down a little like spiral staircase and be like, well, you know, probably a lot of people who are lobbyists are also in the same like economic class as the people who make our laws. Like, you know, yeah. I feel like most people who are in Congress are millionaires. Like, right. Isn't that like... they're people who don't, and they're older, and they're, you know, they don't see the material difference that something like recycling makes on a, like the average person who makes less or, and is not in a higher social class. And it like, it to me, you would also need to be like, make it easier to vote. It's like, and yeah. have ranked voting. And then you also like, maybe have to create a different mindset where I was reading the latest David Graeber book, and it was talking about indigenous people in America society versus like traditional European society, and like he's like by contrast, like European traditional society is very like patriarchal. There is like the freedom comes from the man of the house, and then delegate, like his freedom comes from all the people who serve him. And I was just like, oh, that's so interesting that we don't have this idea of collective freedom, that we all can do what we want, but we're working together. We have this idea of freedom from the top, if that yes. makes any sense. And I'm like, that is something really deep that I never thought about.
Yeah, I feel like I get that, because I often think about people who are very into capitalism and think that it means freedom. As I'm like, no, it just means freedom to exploit other people.
It means freedom for you.
Freedom for you to exploit people beneath
but
you.
But then I'm like, that's not really that free, because no. everyone else is not in their capacity. Like, you don't... like, it's like those movies... okay, there's like this movie, I think it was called like Magic Beach or something, I forget, but it was like one of those 80s movies where it's like this guy is like on Venice Beach and he finds like a genie in a bottle, and the genie's like, what wish can I grant you? And he's like, I want this person to fall in love with me. And then it's like, but the love isn't real. If you make a wish for it, you have to get the love yourself. Like, how do you know if the person really likes you? Like, to me, it's like the same thing. It's like, how do you know you're really free if not everyone else is just as free? How do you know if people really like you if they're not as free?
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's like, I think like the focus on like the individual, and like it ties into so many elements of this. It ties into the idea of individual accountability. Like, if you just recycled harder, there wouldn't be a trash barge in the ocean that China's sending back to us because it's full of maggots, you know? Or yeah. like individual accountability too. Like, you know, if you too could be the CEO of ExxonMobil profiting from all of this plastic production.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things going on where yeah. it's like, I think that, like, yeah, of course our mindsets need to change, and like, but it's also just not all on just the little guys with the straws.
No, I think that, you know, there are things, if it's easy to work into our lives, our little things here or there just to be conscious of, you know?
Yeah, and I don't think you should stop doing that, or people should still try.
People should still try, but we should be easier on ourselves, because we should know that the failure does not, like, the failure to change everything can't be held on our shoulders alone.
Yeah.
You know, you can do whatever makes sense to you that makes sense for, like, your lifestyle and makes you feel okay, like you've done your part, but, like, the trash barge floating in the ocean, or the great trash vortex, the garbage gravy.
Oh, that makes me want to puke.
Even if your goods are out there in it, you know, it's like you've been failed by many systems.
Yeah, but you know, we can still like make it cool to like live in a cool non-garbage place.
Yeah, I think, hot take, I would like to live in a cool, non-garbage place.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I like being trashy, but not in a literal trash way.
We should be the only trash on this planet. Is that it? Is that the episode on garbage?
Yeah.
We did it. Thanks so much for listening to another episode of Pick Me Up, I'm Scared. If you would like to follow us on Patreon, you can find us there at patreon.com/pickmeupimscared. For $2 a month, you can have access to bonus episodes, which we are now recording twice per month. And you can also leave us messages, talk to us, give us episode ideas, whatever floats your boat. But if you don't want to give us your $2 a month, that's totally cool, man. We're just happy you're here.